every time we have a meeting on water, it's not very controversial, so we don't have very many people show up. We're glad to have you here with us to have this meeting today. My name is Kent Jones, and I am the state engineer for the state of Utah. I've been appointed by the governor to be the director of the Division of Water Rights. Senator, welcome.
Hey, I know.
Good to have you here. And as such, we have the opportunity and responsibility to go around the state and look at water situations, both surface and groundwater. We help regulate that. I know many of you are involved in those processes. We have commissioners around the state. I think there's 35 different systems that we regulate and have people on those systems. Just whole job is to set head gates where they need to be set so that people helps people get along and just helps us share this valuable resource that we have of water. One of the responsibilities is that we have in the state of Utah is to watch our groundwater basins. And those groundwater basins, it tells me in the statute, if we are consistently exceeding the safe yield, which is the amount of water that comes in every year to a basin, if we consistently exceed that, then we're supposed to come in and help regulate the groundwater usage in that area so that we stay to safe yield, okay? We were concerned about some of the basins in this area. We went out in Burl Enterprise. We're working in Cedar City area with some groundwater issues that we have. We know we've had some concerns here. We watch the annual reports. Every year the USGS puts out a report to show us where the groundwater levels are. And we see things going like this. That's great. But several of our basins in the state look like this. And they go like this, and they're headed this way, which means we're actually pulling out more water than we're actually getting in the groundwater basin. And so that raises a red flag for me, and my responsibility is that we need to come in and look at, see what's happening, and see what kind of problems there are, and see what kind of solutions we can come up with. So recognizing that we've got a problem here in this space, and we actually came back and contracted with the USGS, come in and do a study. That study was completed last year. Right, they were able to do that study. It took about 4 years for them to go through and pull together some data and look at it. And the purpose that we're meeting here tonight is to share that information that we found out. And we've analyzed that data. We've gone through it. And I've got a few presenters that are going to talk to you tonight just a little bit about what that study is, what we're looking at, what problems we see, and we're going to talk a little bit about our policy here, about what we do, what we approve, and what we historically, just how it's developed. We're going to talk to you a little bit about that. And I know some of you are intimately familiar with water over the years. And I was a state hearing officer for 21 years, and I know I've had some involvement. I ran into Sam when he was really young, okay, talking about water, and I just remember talking about water issues there, just hearing about struggles. This was clear back in the 80s when we were talking about things and about problems here and concerns that we have with the uses. And it's important for us to be involved in this. It's important for us to understand what's happening, and it's important for us to understand that we're all part of this. This is part of our life. And I don't want a state engineer to come in here and say, this is what we have to do. What I'm really trying to encourage you to do is find out all we can about this. Let us tell you what we know. Let us talk about the history. Let's talk about groundwater management plans. We're going to talk about those tonight, about what may be coming here in the future, about how we're going to work together to try to solve problems that I think we're headed to right now from the information that we have. So I want us to be aware of what's happening. We're encouraging citizen groups to get together as a citizens advisory committee to kind of pull groups together to kind of talk and help give the community and the state engineer some counsel on what we ought to be doing with the groundwater situation. Because it's a problem that we all share. Even though statutorily I have a responsibility to do this, you people have the opportunity to live here and use this precious resource, and we need to find a way that we can make it all work for everybody and still meet what we want to do in the future. So what we're going to do just for the time that we're here, and we're anticipating about an hour. Nate came in with some additional slides, so it could be 3 hours. No, we'll try to keep this as short as we can. But But to let you know, we usually plan on about an hour to talk about through these things. But I'm going to have the agenda then. Nate's going to talk first. Nathan Moses is a regional engineer. I know many of you have dealt with Nate, and he's going to be talking about our water policy and our history. After that, we're going to talk about this Parowan Valley study by the USGS. I'm going to talk about this and the reports that we've got. We'll tell you a little bit about what we're finding and some of the problems we're seeing, and what's going to raise some things before us that we're going to have to solve some problems here. We're going to point those out. And then we're going to talk about groundwater management plans. Boyd Clayton, who's the deputy state engineer, will be talking about those. James Greer is an assistant state engineer involved in our technical studies for the state of Utah. He's going to talk about the studies and more about that. But we'll go to Nate, and then we'll go to James, and then we'll go to Boyd, right? And then we're going to open it up to questions and have some discussions later, and then we'll just go from there, see what questions they have, so you want to do. So, let me turn the time over to you.
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
Is there anyone who has signed an offer? Thank you.
Good. And it would be very important to have you do that, because as we communicate with everybody, we're going to use this list to make sure, particularly because you've expressed an interest by being here, we're going to make sure you're kept informed of everything that we're doing here and everything that we do in the future. So it would be good to have that list.
I think so, sir.
How many things I can do?
Okay. Okay, Nate.
It's on.
You just have to turn this on.
Testing. Okay, like Kenton introduced, my name is Nathan Moses, and I do my duty of you, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight. He gave me the task of discussing the policy that we now have and the history of that policy and how we got to where we're at today. These are the two slides. The next two slides are ones that I did add, and the rest of them have as much information on as possible, so we can spend a lot of time on them. I'm just kidding. But the first slide is a diversion depletion slide that shows by priority, or by the day these water rights were established, how we accumulated the water rights that we have on our books now. So if you'll notice, and the important point to take from this is around the 1945 to 1955, you see a big uptick in the amount of filings that we receive at the office and approved. These are approved filings. So as we go further on into this presentation, you'll see that we establish what the safe yield of this valley is, and it was during that time that we passed through the safe yield of the valley. And so we accumulated more water rights on our file than the valley was actually able to sustain. And it was in the meetings. This next slide is the depletion slide. It's just that bottom curve, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later. But this slide, what it shows you, September 30th, 1970, Hubert Lambert, who was the state engineer at that time, came down and met with the people in the valley and talked about how things were beginning to look like they were overdrafted. And it was at that time that he established a policy and shut the basin down to further appropriations. And some of the things they said, I'm going to have to look up here, I can't see that one. He said, the policies that will be set forth here at this meeting will be the way the state engineer will operate until another meeting is held. And Gerald Stoker, who had my position back then, made these notes. So summary on the wells in Parowan Valley. You have a total number of unapproved applications of 7,700. Your approved applications of 21,000, and these are acre feet, for a total number of 28,700 acre feet. You have perfected 37,300 acre feet for a total number of 66,150 acre feet. And he made the observation that if all of these approved applications were perfected, that you would double the depletions in the valley. So this was kind of a critical time period. One note that I made here is that the majority of the 21,000 acre feet of approved applications was irrigation water, and the depletion of that irrigation water totaled 17,000 acre feet, and so they added that much more depletions to the aquifer. Woody Sandberg was also at that meeting. He represented the Utah United States Geological Society. He said that it seems the water level came up in the whole area about the 1930s, talking about the level in the aquifer. up until about 1950, and then they more or less leveled off and started down. And so you can see through the whole valley that the water level is going down. As near as you get to the heavily pumped areas, the more they go down, which is to be expected. And State Engineer Lambert at that time also said, I think these two presentations illustrate to you some of the problems that we have in Marijuana Valley. We have a large number of approved applications that have not been perfected, and if all of them were perfected up to the approved amount, we would double the draw from Marijuana Valley. And that's essentially what happened, because they did end up approving those applications, or allowing those approved applications to become perfected. I need to be careful that's said right. One of the notes that Mr. Sandberg made was that a lot of these appropriations came as people were coming home from World War II, starting about 1945, and looking for a way to provide for their family, and so they came and became irrigators and have enjoyed that ability since. So this is the policy that they intended to adopt when they came out of that meeting. And for the sake of time tonight, I'm not going to go through every little thing, but what I need you to take away from this is that those approved applications were given a limited amount of time to become perfected. They had to go and hire a proof engineer, prove up on those water rights, and get a certificate. And they were supposed to do that before December 31st, 1971. That was for the irrigation, the large things, the municipal, industrial, and subdivisions. For the small applications that were just stock watering domestic, they gave them until December 31st, 1972. Well, as things go, many of the users were not able to get their proofs in on time. And so at the request of many of the users of the valley, they sent out this letter on the left where State Engineer Lambert gave them another 6 months, I think it was, to file their proofs and then be done. And at that time, the State Engineer issued a final policy. And this is what we have. This is the policy that was established following that letter. First, it was that no further wells would be drilled under subject applications. There must have been an isolated incident with Zitting. He was allowed to complete his present well. No further extensions in order to clear new land. Proof must be submitted by June 1st, 1972. They were to reject pending applications that were not perfected and change applications within this area subject to prior rights and interference problems and consider under individual merits. Further studies were made in Parowan Valley, and then Parowan Valley was closed at that time to any further appropriations, regardless of the size. So what's interesting is that was 1972, and I've talked with a lot of the people that I know that have worked for the division, and we can't figure out where we got from that policy to what we've been operating under today. So if anybody knows, please let me know. But there were some slight changes to it. The graph on, or the picture on the right, shows the bottom of Township 32 South, and that separates the Buckhorn from the rest of the valley. That was treated as an administrative boundary where you couldn't cross one way or the other, and we adopted that sometime in that that time period. And so the policy did get refined a little bit, and this is how we operate today. First, all waters in the basin are appropriated. There was no new appropriations after that. The basin was divided into those two sub-areas, the Buckhorn and the southern area. Any change application proposing a change from surface to underground sources or vice versa will be critically reviewed to assure hydrologic connection and that there are no enlargement of the underlying water rights and that there will be no impairment of other water rights because of a change application. And finally, water rights for the mountain headwaters and brine head resort are generally restricted to change applications on first priority rights on Parowan Main Creek or Summit Creek, and applications proposing to transfer between those two basins up on the mountain, Parowan and Man Creek, and Summit Creek drainages would not be approved. So that's where we're at today. That's how we operate. I know that you're familiar with that policy. And that's the information that I have. Do you have any questions or comments from the group? Okay, and we'll turn the time to the next presenter.
Like Ken said, my name is James Greer. I work with the Division of Water Rights in Salt Lake. I help manage a section of the office that deals with the hydrologic studies, and I'm going to be going over these studies and the data here for the Parowan Valley here today. As I'm going along, feel free, you can interrupt me and ask questions, specifically if we're talking about something on the slide that I'm showing right then. Let's just have the questions go as I'm going along so they're fresh in our minds. So I'm going to show, just to start off here today, when we're talking about the Parowan Valley, this is the boundary that we're going with the, we can have Parowan Creek here, Summit Creek, a couple of the other smaller creeks up above, all the way up to the drainage divide between here and the Beaver Valley to the north, right down to the drainage divide between here and the Cedar City Valley to the south. So that's the area that we're talking about. And if you have questions about what's included, what's not, please come up to me after the meeting and we can look at a bigger map and go over those details if you have questions about that. We want to make sure that was clear what the area we're talking about here is today. And it does go up the canyons up to the drainage divide in all of these areas. The Parowan Valley, right, there is no surface water that leaves this valley. It's a terminal area. And we believe that the groundwater system is also similar to that, that there is possibly some, the studies will show there is maybe some outflow that's happening underneath the ground, but it's probably pretty minimal at this point based on the development that's happening. So this whole valley is being treated as one small hydrologic basin, right? To kind of confirm that, let's see how you can kind of see here. Oh, it's kind of hard to see. These yellow lines on here are the groundwater surface contours, right? This kind of shows you how the water is flowing through the ground here. So the water flows from the mountain ranges here north, kind of south, and from the larger drainage out of the mountains kind of west to east, most of it terminating here out in the Little Salt Lake area is kind of what is believed. Historically, they thought some water did flow south towards Cedar City Valley, but as I'll talk about later, that's probably pretty minimal now at this point. So this water system, the water's coming, recharging into these mountain blocks, flowing out into the valley fill, aquifer through the ground, and historically would have resurfaced in springs and seeps and discharge areas along the eastern section of the valley. That's the general understanding of how hydrology works in this valley. Other thing to note on this slide, this here is a representation of the transmissivity, or how easy the water flows through the groundwater system. So why I wanted to bring this up is there is this area between what is known as the Buckhorn, right, and kind of the central part of the valley. There is this little area here where the geology shows that there's some sort of restriction or the water does not flow as easily through that area. So it still does flow north to south here, but there is some restriction, and that's kind of what causes that spring area that used to be in this area, right? Forced that water there kind of to surface. Now, a lot of those springs have not flowed for a while. So the water there, still under the groundwater system, still does flow north to south. But that is one of the issues we want to bring up, that there is sort of a distinction between that Buckhorn and the rest of the valley. It is hydrologically connected, and water does flow through there, but there is some restrictions in that area. So, why are we here today? Right, we have this report that the USGS does for us. It's called the groundwater conditions. The USGS go out and maps water levels. They take measurements about the depth of water all over the state. And Parowan is one of these areas. And so they monitor what is going on with this groundwater system by looking at water levels. I have a lot of slides here that are going to show different water level trends throughout the whole valley. Okay? So we're starting in the southern part of the valley here, down here near Summit, and you're seeing water level trends that are heading downward, right? You'll see in a lot of these graphs that in the early 80s was a very wet season, and you'll see these bumps that the water levels responded to big years of recharge from large snowpack years. but the general trend is a downward trend. So that indicates to us that there's something going on here. Most likely, like Ken alluded to, that we're using more water than is on average recharged in this area. So I'm going to go through each of these areas as we kind of walk up the valley. And you see this same general trend. There's a scale here on the left that, you know, back in the before the 1960s, the depth of the water was about 60 feet here, and now it's down below 100 feet, right? So at this location, this well, the water levels are 40 to 50 feet deeper than they were 60, 70, 80 years ago. And you see that trend all the way up the valley. As we move up the valley, you continue to see in some of these heavier pump zones, right, water levels in the early 80s, right, were about 40 feet deep, are now over 120 feet deep in that area there. Similar trends, right? So if there's anything else I wanted to point out on these slides. Just want to make a note that all this data is available, and I'll show you where you can get access to it on our website when I'm done here. So I can show you how you can access and visualize any of this data in different formats. So the last thing here is you look up on the northern part of the valley. You don't see as dramatic of drawdowns in this area where you've got those tighter sediments. Water's not flowing as well. But above that, up on the Buckhorn area, you are seeing some water level declines as well on the order of magnitude of 30, 40 feet. Okay? I have this slide here. This shows let's turn this off, hopefully. This works. Okay, so this is an animation showing the years. You can see them counting down up there, 1965, 1966. It shows the water level map and how it's changing over time. So I'll just let that kind of play, and you kind of see these colors. We're seeing this water level surface drop in this valley. We're now up to the 80s, and so you're seeing some recovery happening because of those wet years. And then after the 80s, it starts to drop some more. So you have these heavier pump zones in the center part of the valley, and you're seeing there on the scale magnitude of 80 up to 100 feet of drawdown. Up to today. So you see some drawdowns that happen up here from the heavily pumped areas. There is a geologic reason why you don't see as much drawdown in this area because of those tighter sediments that are there. And then down in the larger agricultural area in the valley, you're seeing quite a bit of drawdown over hundreds of feet. A hundred feet about a drawdown in that area. As this, we're utilizing this water, this storage that's down in the ground. Are there any questions about any of that? Yes?
Can you, do you have an idea of how long it takes for a good water year, surface water, to manifest in the aquifer, these levels that you're talking about, you know, when there might be a little gain that might correspond to a good water year?
Yeah. So you can see that, you see this bump happen, right? Right about the early 80s. And it's pretty instantaneous. It's about a year to 2 year delay. But it's pretty quick that it responds to these wetter and drier years. So you can kind of see in 2011, we had a new year, you see a little bump in a lot of these graphs. You see them flatten out a little bit because of that. All right, so it responds pretty quickly.
It's the same year.
Mm-hmm. Now these water levels, what they do is they take a water level measurement every spring before the irrigation happens. So it kind of adjusts from that winter, they take a level, and then the next year they take a level. So it's kind of responded to that winter that they had the year before. So you do see cycles and trends, and you see it kind of up and down and bounce a little bit depending on these years, but you do see a general downward trend even through the 80s. Good question. Any other questions on that data? So like Kent said, this is the data we're looking at to say, okay, obviously there's something going on here. These water levels are going down. So there's been many studies that have done all around the state, and this valley is no different. They started studying this back in there was a study done in 1946, right, by the U.S. Geological Survey, looking at the groundwater resources of this area. There was a focus study done in 1978, once again, looking at, okay, what is the resource of this area? How we manage it. I'm sure that was instigated by some of these policy meetings that we had, new policies to shut down the basin. They wanted to understand it better. So as we've seen these water levels continue to go down, we came out in 2015, had a meeting and proposed, hey, you know, we want to make sure we have the best science and data available. Let's hire the USGS once again to come out and with their new methodologies and technologies, do some better estimates of what the groundwater situation is like here in the valley. So we did that, and these are the studies that came from that. There were two studies, ended up being two reports, let's say. It was one study, but two reports that came out of that study where they looked at this whole basin. What they did in these studies, and what we asked them to do is, okay, we want to understand this groundwater budget, this balance. How much water is coming into the valley, to the aquifer? How much water is discharging out of this valley fill aquifer? Analyze all these components, right? The precipitation, the seepage that's coming from the return flow from irrigation or from the streams. Is there any subsurface outflow still happening in the valley, coming into the valley possibly, or leaving the valley? How much water is being used from the wells, right? How much is being pumped? What evapotranspiration is possibly still occurring from native vegetation in the valley? What valley springs? And look at this whole water budget and come up with their best estimates to understand how much water we have on an annual basis, on average, long term. And so they did that. These are the two studies. Here's some key findings from the study, right? They looked at all those areas, and they concluded some things about how much water, on average, is recharging, how much water we're taking out of storage every year. There's a big volume of water that's just in storage in the ground, okay? So I'm going to go into a lot of detail about each one of these components that they looked at. One of the other things they do, and it's in this report as well, they estimate the amount of water that's being pumped, how much water is coming from the wells for the city or for the irrigation. It's predominantly water for irrigation in the valley. And so they do these estimates. They looked back a little while and noticed that on average about 32,000 acre feet per year is being pumped since 1994. But more recently, if you look at an average of just the late, you know, from 2010 and on, it's actually higher than that. It's probably around 35,000 acre feet. Okay, so more recently we've been pumping more, but if you look at a more longer term average, it's about that 32,000 acre feet of water being pumped out of the ground. One interesting thing to note, when they looked at this water that's being pumped out for irrigation, most of the method of irrigation here is sprinklers, right? The majority of the irrigation that's happening from groundwater pumping is out more west, out in the valley where there's tighter sediments that would not be conductive to a lot of that water that's being applied to the land to be seeping deep into the ground back into the aquifer. And so the study shows that most of the water that's pumped out of the ground is actually consumed. It's not, it doesn't return back into the groundwater system. That's a little different than we see in a lot of other areas where you pump water out, you put it on the ground, and some of that still will percolate deep down back into that aquifer system. Here, they didn't believe that that was happening, that the water that was being pumped out of the ground was mostly being consumed. Question? Sorry, what was that again?
Consumptions were about 40% for recharge on irrigation in the past.
So they did look at a lot of the surface water that's applied more up on the benches. They do believe a lot of that surface water does recharge back into the ground. Not on the order of 40%, it is much larger than what they believe is happening from the well pumping. So they looked at all that to say, okay, how much water is actually pumping out and being consumed? So they believe about 95% of that water that's pumped doesn't get back down into that aquifer system. The surface water is a little different because where it's applied, but the groundwater, that is their belief. So based on all the study that they did and our interpretation of all the numbers, they did a numerical model of this valley to look at things. These are the numbers that we have pulled out of their conceptual understanding of this valley. That on average, there's possibly up towards 36,000 acre feet of water that gets into this valley. Then there's outflow that happens, such that these are... Let me make sure to describe this right. This is not just the valley fill. This is the whole groundwater system, mountain block, and valley fill. So of all the precipitation that happens in the valley, they believe about 36,000 acre feet of water gets into the groundwater system. But a lot of that is discharge or base flow in the mountain streams, the Paramount Creek, Summit Creek. So that's water that's going in the groundwater and coming out of those creeks and flowing out of the canyons. Okay? So if we look at how much water is going in, how much water is coming out, the amount, this number here, conceptually, is how much is getting into the valley fill aquifer that could be used for pumping. Okay, I want to make sure that's kind of well understood, but that's a key component to this.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Why aren't the streams, why don't they contribute to the aquifer?
So that's a good question. They do. So you can see that we'll have water that, let me go back to this slide. So they have precipitation, right? It'll fall in the mountains, and then some of that will come out as stream flow,
right.
Comes down out, and a lot of that's diverted, right, and used. But what isn't diverted will come hit these benches, and they do look at that. It'll recharge back into that system. And so they looked at that, right? So if we come here, they'll show, right, 36,000 came in. A lot of it, 15,000 acre feet, went back into those streams. But a little bit went back, once it was in the stream, back down into the groundwater system again. So they did seepage runs along the streams to look at, okay, from here to here, how much is going in and how much is coming out of those streams. And so they did look at that, and these are the numbers that they came up with. Okay, so we also looked at this groundwater basin. We've got these water levels, right, that are going down. And so we did estimates of how much water. If you have the water level surface was like this, and now it's gone down, what volume of water has been taken out of the groundwater system? Because if we can understand that, we can see, okay, how much are we taking out per year that's not being replenished? Right? Because there's much going in, there's some coming out. The change in that storage will help us understand how much over-allocated we possibly are in the valley. So we've looked at that as well independently. So there's a range, because you've got some assumptions in these numbers, right? You've got a very complicated groundwater system. But as we look at that, it appears that about 8 to 11,000 acre feet on average is being removed from storage each year. Okay? That's the volume of water coming out of the groundwater system that's not being replenished. We're taking much more than that, but part of that is being replenished each year on average. And you kind of see that, you know, in the 60s, it kind of went up a little bit, but in the early 80s it went up a little bit, but since then it's been on the kind of downward trend that we're taking more and more water out of storage than we can get replenished each year. Question.
So if it was like a financial model, we're in the red, 8,000 to 11,000 acre feet operating in the red.
Yes. That's what these numbers are showing us, somewhere in that range. Okay? So what does that all mean? We look at the water rights. Okay? We have approved on our books somewhere around 32,000 acre feet of depletion that's approved to be withdrawn and depleted out of this valley by irrigation. Most of it's irrigation. It's broken out by different, but as you can see, vast majority is irrigation. So, summarizing, the groundwater system is being used faster than it's being replenished by natural recharge. The USGS believes, based on their studies, that there's a range between 18 to 22,000 acre feet is how much is on average being recharged in this basin every year. Okay, based on the history that we have. When we look at the change in storage, we said it's probably about 8 to 11,000 acre feet. So when we put all those numbers together, right, our well depletion on average is 30,000, even though the past few years has been higher than that, and the allowed amount of water rights is about 32,000, we're showing that we're pretty much utilizing all the existing water rights in the valley. There are other valleys where there's a lot of approved but unperfected or unutilized water, but that's not the case here. Most of the water rights that have been approved are actually in use today, because we're seeing that this is the average right here, but we're more close to this over the last couple of years. So they believe what's sustainable is somewhere between 18 to 22,000 acre feet. Okay, so if this is all true, if these numbers are accurate. Sorry, there's a question.
Let's go back and that slide that had diversion and depletion and explain the difference, please.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So a water right has a couple parameters that are associated with it. The diversion is how much water you can divert from the natural system to apply to your beneficial use. So for irrigation, in this valley, your water allows you to divert 4 acre feet per acre. And that's normally what someone would divert if they were flood irrigating alfalfa. But most of that water is not consumed. It either runs off or depercolates. And so your depletion is how much is actually consumed by that use.
And that was the past assumption. That was the 40% assumption.
Yes.
But you're now looking at a different assumption.
Yes.
A different assumption about depletion versus diversion.
Correct. And so what you see happen is most pumpers are not going to be divert this much because they don't want to divert more than they have to. That's cost, right? So they're diverting more closely to what they're depleting, and they're much more efficient in their application so that there's not that return flow. Does that answer your question then? Okay. So what this would be, if this is determined to be the safe yield, it would mean that somewhere about this much acre feet would have to be reduced on average so that the water levels would be sustained in this valley. We would stop seeing that drawdown happening. We're not looking to try to restore the water levels back to where they were at any given time, just to maintain an average annual use so that we're not using more than what's on average replenished in the valley. This looks pretty accurate based on our estimates of what the change in storage is in the valley. So these are some large numbers. It's a large percentage of the use That is all I was going to present on the data today. These studies are available, and let me even show, let me put this down for a second. So on our website, waterrights.utah.gov, if you Google Water Rights Utah, this will be our homepage. Right from our homepage, under laws and agreements, there's groundwater management plans. Oh, what's showing up here? let's do this.
There's a depletion in signal.
Okay. There we go. Okay, let me go back to our homepage. We have waterrights.utah.gov. There's a couple different ways to get there, but under laws/agreements, there's groundwater management plans. Boyd's going to talk a lot more about groundwater management plans, but if you come down here, these are all the plans we have around the state. We have a new link here for Parowan Valley, which is where we're going to post all the information from the public meetings, this data, everything on. As you come down here, you can see the groundwater level data is right here under this link. These are the different studies you can get online. This is a the public meeting we're having here today. We'll post this presentation, the audio from this presentation. We're recording the meeting. Be all available to you. This link right here, we talked about all those water rights and those diversion depletion. This is a listing of all the water rights in the valley ordered by, we have by priority date. Who owns them, and what their estimate of diversion and depletion are. This is a list that we would gladly accept help as you're the owners of these water rights to review to make sure we have accurately represented these water rights. This is our database. There's a lot of water rights. There's, you know, how many is there? 1,000 or so in the valley. As you're going down here, and you can see as we get down to the bottom, that's that 52,000 acre feet of diversion versus 32,000 acre feet of depletion cumulative that's been approved in the valley. This priority list, I think, Boyd, you'll talk a little bit more about why this is important as we look at this groundwater management plan in the future. But all this data is available online for you to review, look at, and we're looking for help to understand it and provide feedback. That was all I was going to present today. Are there any questions before I hand off to Boyd, who's going to talk about plans? Yes?
If nothing else changes, what year does the aquifer go dry?
I'm sorry, if nothing else changes.
What year does the aquifer go dry?
So, if you couldn't hear the question, if nothing else changes, what year does the aquifer go dry? You know, that's not something I've looked at. There is a lot of water in storage, but eventually it would run out of water. There are, as we're taking 8,000 to 10,000, 12,000 acre feet out of storage each year, it would take a while.
How long is a while? 50 years, 100 years?
It would probably be hundreds of years.
Possibly be out of business, Coach.
But those water levels will continue to drop. And so it'll get, at some point, I haven't looked at it here. When we looked at it, and we did the same plan at Barrel Enterprise, it at some point, it becomes not economical to pump from those ranges. When we looked at it there, it took 50 to 100 years before it probably became uneconomical. I have not looked at it here in this valley, though, because it depends on a lot of different factors. Does that answer your question? But we can look at it and provide information. There was a question back there first, and then we'll come here.
Go drive around the Antelope Valley around Lancaster, California. There used to be thousands of acres of paper on there, and now it's just dry field. Like, you got to the point that's coming for the pump.
Yeah, so and that's really the limiting factor in these areas. It's just the cost affordably to pump from depth versus running out of storage in the aquifer.
Do you have any projections on the recharge rates?
Yes. Are
you just straight lining the recharge rates from this year on, or are you
No, we've done, they've looked at and done an average. That's what these numbers are, averages, but they look at year to year. These studies do have how much they believe is recharged on every year going back through the study.
I'm talking about in the future.
Oh, in the future, they have done in their modeling some projections of what they think, but they just use the past hydrology to do those projections. They haven't looked at climate change to see how that would affect it or whatnot, but most of the science is predicting that we would probably have less water in the future, and we're being conservative and saying if we had just what we've had in the past future, this is the situation we'd be in. Question?
Just going over numbers, and I don't know why you've done right, but you're, to get back to safe yield, we're looking at close to 50% cut?
30%.
It depends on those ranges, but somewhere between 30 to 40%. If those ranges are where it ends up, we're still looking at it, making sure we're right there, but it is a pretty dramatic amount of water.
Do we have any clue on, you say we're using our existing water rights, but in that there's a fair amount that's still not being used. Like the city, for example, how much water is Fairwood City on that's not being used?
I don't know, Fairwood City.
Anyway, do we have any numbers relative to that? You say we're, as far as acre feet, we're pumping what we should be if they were all being used to their limit. But that being said, some of them are still not being used. Maybe not very much. But
yeah. We've looked at that, and it appears that there's not very much that aren't being used. Now, there obviously is some, right? There is some acres that's not in production. There's some acres that's not using their full possibility of pumping that they could be using. But as we've looked at it, it looks, based on the last 5 years or so, that we're using pretty much the full allocation of water. Now, the city probably has it a little bit, but it's not a very large city. I think when we go back to
1,200 acre feet,
the slides.
I think we have 1,200 acre feet.
This slide here. So yeah, there's 1,200 acre feet of diversion depletion that's currently in the name of the city. They might have other rights that they haven't updated title on or whatnot, but that's about how much water that they have water rights for. I don't know. I can look up. I can look up while the next presenter's going how much water the city has been reported they've been using over the last many years and see how that compares.
That's all right. As far as I'm aware, they just have some that hold. You know.
They're most likely holding some for future growth.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I'm sure they are. I hope they are. Are there any more questions?
So, excuse me.
Yes.
So, in the numbers that you've given us so far, I think someone asked a question about considering the possibility that we receive less moisture in future years. You've just mapped it out as if we're going to receive about what we've been getting over this past study period.
Correct.
And you also haven't factored in a growth percentage for the city or increased number of water users in the valley.
We have looked at a little bit about the city. We have not increased any more growth as far as irrigation.
Of course.
But we don't. Our policy is we wouldn't allow any more growth at this point. Okay, well, if you have more questions as you're thinking about this, we'll be here after, but I'm going to turn the time over to Boyd to talk about groundwater management plans now.
First of all, is there anyone else who hasn't signed the roster? All right, I think you're about to be as much as you can door, so we'll try to get through this quickly. I have the assignment to talk about the law. Groundwater management plans are a tool that the legislature gave the state engineer to regulate groundwater. With surface water systems, we all know that you can see what's in the creek or in the ditch, and you take your water by your turn or by your priority. And so the first person gets their water before the all their water before the next person gets their water. It's not quite as easy.
Can I go backwards or forward? There we go.
It's not quite as easy with groundwater. And so the legislature has given us some tools to figure out how to manage groundwater when we are approaching what's available in the resource. And over the years, since 2005, when the groundwater management statute was adopted in the state code, we've developed groundwater management plans throughout the state, and we're continuing to do that as we see areas that have issues with groundwater. The statute says that the state engineer may develop a groundwater plan, management plan to regulate the groundwater in an area by going through a process. That process includes public notice. That's why all of you received notice of this meeting tonight, because we're starting to talk about a groundwater management plan in this area. We don't decide it all in one night, so this isn't the decision-making meeting. This is an informational meeting to help you start to understand the nature of the problem as we begin to study it and go through the steps we need to develop a groundwater management plan. As I mentioned, surface water is relatively easy to figure out how to manage when there's a shortage, because you can see it and you can measure it. Groundwater is a little trickier because most of us can't see underground that well. And so, as James described, what we do is we try to look at indicators of what's going on in the ground. So we monitor groundwater levels. We try to monitor withdrawals from the groundwater system, try to look at ways that water is being consumed by the groundwater system, and make estimates of water that may be going into the groundwater system. Here's my simple model of a groundwater system. Obviously, on groundwater is in a hole in the ground. It's soil, and there are spaces in between the soil particles. And that's where the water goes in the groundwater system, is in those spaces between the soil particles. But if we ignore those for a minute and look at the big tub on the left, I have a hose sticking in it at one end, and there's water running out on the other end. That's what this system was naturally. As James alluded to, that water was probably either naturally evaporating from the lake to the west or running over into the valley to the south, the Cedar City Valley. That was probably the natural overflow. As we started using water in the basin, then the overflow slows down and diminishes. So the question is, what's sustainable? How many buckets can you take out of this before it doesn't work anymore? Thoughts? Okay, that's the place that the legislature has told us to work from, is as we manage groundwater basins in the state, we should manage for a sustainable supply. That means that we shouldn't be taking out from the groundwater system on average more than is coming in. Okay? Otherwise, this happens, and that's what's happening in your basin, is that the groundwater will withdraw from the soil particles, and you'll have drawdown in your wells, and you'll have to go deeper with water. And so the objectives of groundwater management plan are to limit the groundwater withdrawals to what we call safe yield. Which in its simplest form means no more than is coming into the aquifer. There's some other constraints as well we'll talk about. The other one is that we're supposed to look at the physical integrity of the aquifer. In Cedar City Valley, to the south of you, we obviously have an integrity problem in Enoch area where they have some fissures and some of the land subsided, made life miserable for a development that was out there because the sewer started running the wrong way. Those are physical integrity issues with the aquifer. They not only manifest themselves at the surface, they also take away storage capacity in the groundwater system, because what's happening is the soil's compacting, and so there'll be less moisture carrying capacity. But as far as we know right now, there isn't a great issue with that in this valley. And so we're not looking at that particularly. The other issue that can happen as you start to use groundwater is degradation of water quality. We have some sampling that's going on as part of the USGS monitoring program. We haven't seen indications that the water quality is changing, so that's not a concern. I don't know if any of you have had any different experience than that. If you have, we'd be curious to know, but at this point, that doesn't seem to be an issue. So what we're looking at as the primary issue in this basin is the total amount of water being withdrawn and how it fits with what would be a safe field. The statute defines a critical management area as a place where we're consistently taking more water from the groundwater basin than is being recharged. So this, we aren't declaring this a critical management area tonight because we're still doing our analysis to establish what the safe field is. But as James has alluded to, this is a critical groundwater management area. So we ought to start thinking about that and facing the fact that that's probably where we're at. As I mentioned, recharge is a starting point. We look at physical integrity, and we look at recharge and try to figure out what that is a number of different ways, because none of us can see water running off the mountain into the rock block or into the groundwater system. We have to make estimates and then balance that with what we think is coming out of the system. And then, as James said, one of the things we do when we are in a system that's declining like this one, we also make estimates of the water that's coming out of storage in the aquifer as it's dropping, and use all of those things together to give us an assurance of where we're at as far as what the recharge of the basin is. The statute provides two methods that we can solve this problem. The one that is the tool the state engineer is given is to manage withdrawals by priority. And that's why James showed you that list of all the water rights in the basin. Every water right has a priority that's based on the date that the application was made to first put that water to use. And so if we're forced, what we will eventually do is draw a line on that priority schedule and say, this is where safe field is. Everybody above that line can no longer divert water. That's a rather harsh reality, and we won't get there quickly. But that's the tool that the legislature has given us. It's the same tool that we use with surface water. In times of scarcity, when there's not enough water for everyone, then it's a priority system, and the one with first in time has the first strike. Yes?
Have you ever done that anywhere?
In groundwater?
Yeah.
No, we haven't yet. Okay. We set up a plan in Rural Enterprise that we will do that if they don't get it under control. But that goes to the second point here. that the legislature in the statute gave us the ability for people to do voluntary arrangements. What does that mean? It doesn't mean you volunteer your neighbor to take a cut. It means that you can get together and decide together that you want to do it a different way than priority. Yes?
I see the city process as a year or a year and a half ahead. Can you just tell us briefly the status of that plan?
Maybe Kent can summarize that. I'll leave that to him, all right? But they're moving on a path where they're trying to work on some voluntary arrangement ideas, and we're trying to give them plenty of time to do that. And we're planning to do the same here. I'm not speaking for the state engineer, but that's my understanding, is we didn't come down tonight to draw the line and say everybody above the line's off. We're trying to find a way to solve the problem cooperatively. And so we're looking for you to start putting on your thinking caps and get together and talk about, is there a way that we can do this that would be better than doing it by priorities? Okay. The one thing the statute does give us is the ability to look at the economic situation and gradually implement whatever solution we decide needs to be implemented. So if we reduce by priority, we can do that gradually, and that's what's happening in the Berlin Enterprise area and the groundwater management plan that's been adopted there.
Is there a water table coming up with that?
No. And the goal isn't to make their water table come up. The goal is to make it stop going down.
So another question I have, when you were talking previously about the study that was done with the recharge versus the draw, I don't know how you could do an accurate study on the recharge when the water flow. I know that our water coming out of the canyon on my surface water varies from morning to night. Also, with the storms we had last summer, there was a time when the water flowed out of our canyon, 30 feet deep, 20 feet wide for 8 hours. How do you monitor and justify and do an accurate study with all those varying factors?
So there have been a number of algorithms developed with various basins in the West, mostly by the United States Geologic Survey, that takes into account the precipitation, the type of formations that the water is going over, and makes estimates of recharge that occur from that. That's not the best science, okay? It's a rough estimate. And that's why we look at the other end. We look at the discharge. We can actually map phreatophytes and plants that are taking water out of the groundwater system, map what's actually being irrigated, and make good estimates of depletion. And so we generally back into that number as strongly as we look at the estimates of recharge. We back into it from discharge and depletion and change in storage.
On an annual basis.
Yeah.
So next year, with the runoff, the floods and rains that we had this last summer, also considering the Bryan Head flood, there's not as much vegetation on the mountain using up more water. I noticed that our stream didn't change from the previous year, even though we had less snowpack last winter, because of the vegetation not being there, taking up a lot of the moisture. So there's all those other factors, too.
Yes, and there
is... We'll
see
that next year, right?
Yeah, there's still going to be some effects from the fire, that there'll be more water in the valley because the vegetation's using less. But the vegetation will eventually come back up there. And so that will give us a couple of years. That won't save the day.
Hanging on for every year we can.
Yes.
You're describing here a reduction in use as a solution. Are there any solutions being looked at that would increase the water coming into the aquifer, transporting from another area? Any other ideas to increase the water to go along with the reduction in use?
So in Cedar City Valley, that's actually one of the things they're trying to do, is they're putting in groundwater recharge basins, and they're taking any excess stream flows that come during off-irrigation season and putting that excess water into those discharge basins to try to increase the water supply to the groundwater basin. Obviously, if you have a lake that's evaporating water in the west end of the valley, any water that you can put into the groundwater system instead of having it go there is going to help your situation. But there's a limit there, because that's the only water that we're aware of that's making it out of the basin without being used. Okay? So we can estimate how much you can get that way and see how good we can get at capturing that water and getting it back in the ground. But it probably isn't enough to solve the problem.
Sure.
Okay? So a little bit of it, but it won't solve the whole problem.
How does the Parowan Basin compare with just north over in the Beaver Valley? Are they in trouble too?
I don't want to speculate, but I guess we're going to just keep moving north. Every basin in Utah, because we're developing groundwater, is headed towards this issue.
It seemed like they're sub-irrigated. I mean, they got surface...
They were sub-irrigated.
Not
so much anymore, yeah. We're facing the story up there, too. So we haven't started there yet. I can see Jared looking down. Probably doesn't want us to start up there. The groundwater and surface water are significantly connected in that basin, and that's a serious issue there. So let me hurry and keep going so I don't wear you out. So I want to just talk about where we are headed here. And so a groundwater management plan will require significant scientific research and reporting. And that's what James started to tell you tonight. We're doing scientific studies. We're starting to look at the science of what's going on in this basin. We will continue to do that to try to get the best understanding we can going into a groundwater management plan of where we are and where we need to go. The law requires us to do that. There will be meetings and there will be notice. We're not going to adopt a groundwater management plan in a vacuum. We invited you here tonight because we want you to know what's happening. We want you to stay connected to the process, and we will continue to have meetings and to talk about what's happening and where we're going. We are open to comments and suggestions, as I've just mentioned. We don't think we have all the answers. Each basin is a little different. For instance, just to give you a contrast, in Cedar City Valley, there's a whole lot of paper water. And so if they use all the paper that they have, they'll be in serious trouble. But they actually are not that far off in what they're actually taking from the groundwater aquifer and what it can provide. And so their situation is somewhat different from yours, in that you're using almost all of the paper water that you have. And so we don't have to worry about what could happen to get worse. We just have to worry about how to get back where we need to be. Okay?
How comfortable are you with Enterprise Rural Valley's management plan? I guess I'm just looking. Okay, is that something that we can seriously consider, or is it, are you...
Maybe, is that better left for you, Kent? They put together a plan. It's a plan to get there in a very long time. And the first step of the plan is to reduce their consumption by changing crops. And they're working on that. And we're trying to give them time to see if it'll work. Okay? They haven't turned the corner yet. Okay. Yes.
Along with that same question, how is the usage monitored from our wells in the valley? How can you tell what a well is providing? Is there a meter on it?
Some of the wells in the valley were actually metered for a time as a part of a prior project. And then we look at the actual irrigated acreage and can estimate the depletion based on consumptive use. So we kind of back into what the withdrawals from the wells are based on the land that's irrigated.
So are you, it's the usage.
You want to talk? I'm not the scientist, James is.
I also said they also correlate with power records.
And power records, yeah. We've been doing that for a long time. We've developed correlations between the power records and the amount of water that's pumped from the well based on the rating curve for the pump.
How accurate do you think those are? Well, sounds like they're all investments.
They were really accurate back when water levels were stable and people's pumps always pumped the same amount of water. In the current age where you have pivots and you change things all over, they're not as accurate. They don't work very well. So we're trying to get out of the power record business over time because it's not working as well as it used to. There'll be respect to all water rights and uses as we work through this plan. The system in Utah for water rights isn't based on a preference by use. It's based on priority by the day that you first put the water to use. And so all water rights are considered equal in our eyes as we work through this system. And groundwater management plans are subject to judicial review. So at the end of the day, if you don't like what we do, you can go and see if you can get a judge to get a different decision. We hope we don't end up there, because that just delays the inevitable. And so we hope that we can develop something that we can all work with as we get going on this. I want to just talk about what a groundwater plan, management plan is not. It is not an administrative forfeiture action. So if we end up cutting off some water rights by priority, those water rights are not terminated. They're just like surface water rights when we have to cut by priority. There's not water for them right now, and so you can't divert. If there is water for them, you can come back and divert eventually. Okay, so they're not terminated. You just can't use them while there isn't water available for them. It isn't the creation of a new taxing entity. We're not here to establish a district and develop a tax for anything. You can choose to do that, but that's not part of a groundwater management plan. It's something that we would do. It isn't adopted by popular vote, and so we're not going to ask for a raise of hands at the end of the day. The state engineer will have to make the hard decision about what groundwater management plan he adopts, but he is very clearly interested in your opinion and understanding your ideas about how we might solve the problem. We aren't here to interfere with due process. You obviously have rights as a water right holder, and you can exercise those rights, and we expect to respect the due process rights of everyone that is here. So I think I'm done. Maybe said I was done a while ago properly, but I'll give the microphone to Kent, he can wrap us up.
Hey, thanks, Lloyd and James and Nate for giving the presentations. We're just getting started in this process. I asked how comfortable we were with the Burl Enterprise Program. I got to the point where I was very comfortable because we had a citizens group pulled together. They were talking with us, so they made some suggestions on what they were going to do. But bottom line is I had to come back and set some limits. Here's some time frames, and here's the priority, and understand if we don't get that groundwater level to stabilize and go flat, then the only ability that I have as state engineers to, okay, look at the most junior right, you can't use anymore. Let's just keep moving up that list until we get that groundwater to stabilize. And they've come up with some plans that they're going to work on. And from the discussions I've heard so far, that they've actually been able to reduce their depletions enough that they, in essence, have met their first goal already, which still is a few years out to get there. But they're making some efforts that are very positive. So I'm happy with what they've done there. We've set an extensive time frame, but I look at these things, and we look at how long this has taken, and it looks like in the 40s this started to happen when we approved a bunch of water rights, and over time it's gone down. So I'm not expecting this to get fixed in 5 years, okay? We're going to look at a time of gradual implementation here that we can kind of turn things around before the excessive groundwater declines cause everybody to go out of business. You just can't afford to pump. So we want to come up with a plan that's realistic so we get that stabilized, but not to the point where it's going to cause a whole bunch of problems, okay, with everybody. We look at the economic impacts to the area. We need to be very careful with that. Certainly, if I tell you got to shut your farm well off, it's going to have an economic impact on you. But overall, it's going to help protect everybody else that has the prior rights to be able to use that. So there's just a lot of things we need to look at. I really appreciate input from the local community, because again, it's really our problem. It's your problem. You're the ones that are taking the water. But we need to work together to get this solved the very best that we can. Cedar City. We're about a year and a half ago, we started a process there, and they've got some serious problems that they're trying to deal with. I think they're only overdrafting about 7,000 acre feet right now. They're trying to get that in balance. They're thinking that they can, through recharge projects and some conservation measures and things that they can do to be more efficient with water, they might be able to meet that 7,000 acre foot, get that water back into the ground. But that doesn't provide for any future growth. That doesn't provide for things where you want to go. But so something still needs to be done. Question was asked about, we're going to be meeting with Cedar City again. We've met with them several times, the Cedar City group. They've actually pulled together a citizens advisory committee that they're regularly meeting and coming up with plans. In fact, they've gone ahead and done some things, and they've told us later what they're doing. That's great, but our groundwater contour lines are still looking like this, okay? And we'll watch that, but I think the things that they're doing are going to really help. But there's some things that we need to do to keep working to make that better and make sure that it's going to be long-term. Now, we are, within the next 6 months, we'll be meeting with Cedar City, and we will be finalizing that groundwater management plan with them. And they know, they've seen some drafts and some of our recommendations. They come back to us and said, how about we do this? And I think, that's a good recommendation. And so we're really looking for input to help us do that. But then the bottom line, again, is I want to make sure that we're only using safe fuel. And the recommendations haven't been to exceed safe yield. Let's keep that way down. But no, the recommendations are to meet safe yield, but to get that stabilized, and then we'll come up with some plans to work on. That's what we're really interested in discussing things with you there. There's another question somebody brought up. I don't remember. Yes.
So if we had two or three really strong winters, does that kind of ease things off?
If we have strong winters, I mean, that what we're going to see, and James showed you that model, that in the 80s, it was colored before the 80s, and the 80s happened, and the color went away. But really quickly, it came right back. So if there's anything you do to have control over getting more rain each year, that was great.
I
remember as a young kid watching a movie that was about an issue down here in this region that had to do with some kind of ecclesiastical donations that actually caused it to rain more. So I was pretty impressed with it. Oh, why don't we just do that all the time? Sometimes it seems to work. So I don't know what to do. Up in Salt Lake Valley, I had some people talk to me about the Great Salt Lake, and it's actually getting smaller and smaller. We're losing a lot of water from that. And they asked me what we could do. And one thing that I suggested maybe the legislature ought to pass a law to have more water level or water come into the lake. We regulated at one time in the past that we couldn't get above a certain level. So I thought, if we can do that, let's make sure we get enough water coming in to get it up to that.
Politicians think they have a lot of power, but I'm not sure.
I really appreciate Senator Rickers and what he does. He understands water. He's been very supportive of statewide water planning, and I just appreciate what he's done. But it's a difficult thing to be able to get that. And hopefully we go into a water cycle. But I look at tree ring studies on the Colorado River, and I see that, and I said, what if we're headed down for one of these 200-year dry spells? What are we going to do? I mean, I get worried, and so I'm thinking about retiring for soon. It's troubling when you look at it. I mean, we could be a lot worse than we are. Now, what if this past record that we're using to project where we are is a wet cycle, and we're moving now into a dry cycle? What are we going to do? I had a question. Okay, well, there was one here.
The USGS study has some very differing assumptions: transport evaporations, spillage into the Cedar Valley, the recharging of the aquifer. The state engineer, obviously, you're going to have to make a decision about whether you view those as good science or not. I'm not going to ask what your decision is, but you're going to have to make one, right?
Right. There is a lot of data that's being presented to us and studies that are being done. And as much as we'd like to think that's an exact science, it's not exact. There's some estimates going in there, but the people that are making these estimates are very skilled at doing what they do, and they run models, and they compare those models with what they're actually observing in the field, and they find there's a pretty close correlation of what's going on here. But things can change. And so we're going to try to look at those as close as we can, but the bottom line is at some point we're going to have to make a determination what that is. Now, if we make a determination and we see things stabilize in 10 years, we're going to back right off and just say, hey, we're there. We've met it, and some of the assumptions must have been wrong. Or we're getting more rain, things are coming in, we're just going to come back, and we're not going to have to cut anymore. We'll just stay there. So it just depends on what's happening. You got a question?
The question I have is, if we were to get together as a Parowan Valley Pumpers and establish a fund, call it a tax or whatever, where we set some money into an account for the purpose of buying people's water right to keep it in under the ground and not be used. Has that ever happened in any other aquifers? And would that something like that work? It'll have to be a significant amount of money for somebody that's wants to retire or sell their farm without the water or whatever to buy the water and just keep it in the basin. Not pump it.
Yeah, I don't know that we're doing that. We've seen that occur, but that's certain.
You're allowed under the statutes, and also their soil set up so you could use water rights as a source on a special improvement district. I thought they were talking about it.
There was a discussion at Berlin. Price Senator's Hall was real strong in helping to try to get that pulled together, that there might have been some ways to pull monies together. That is a possibility to do that to help farms retire.
But to do that for 40% of our draw, it would cost more money than anybody would be willing to pay, I think.
To cover the whole loss, that would be difficult. It really would. And so there's considerations out of rural enterprise where they decided to change crop types and go to, rather than growing hay, they've gone growing corn and using the water for something a little different. That's actually helped save quite a bit of the water, but it's not going to get us totally there. So we're just going to have to work. But there are some things that, you know, to get people to stabilize their farms or not use as much water as they're using, you know, that can go to hell, but it is really expensive. Cooperative agreements, and I know we've had this on some streams in the state, where rather than have the state engineer regulate by priority, everybody's agreed to come back and, okay, I'll cut back my farm by a little bit, okay, because I want to share. I don't want my neighbor to have to go out of business, and they've agreed to share this, like the stream, so we're all sharing when the water gets less, and we all share what's there. That's a possibility, but again, that's not my authority or responsibility to do that. I have to come back and say priority. And that's my flag is priority. So.
I noticed on the study that was done last year, there are several wells that have leveled off on the hasn't dropped in our valley from the study just done last year. There's been 2 or 3 years in a row where it stays stable. But you won't take the whole valley in an average, if I suppose.
Right. Yeah. In the Cedar City, we looked at Cedar City Valley. What's happening there? We've had 90 to 100 foot of drawdown in some areas there. We've actually got some wells that have come up. That was the same in Burl Enterprise. One of the wells that the city owns actually came up. It was right in the line of Shoal Creek coming down the surface source, coming down where the heavy recharge was, and then it went out into the valley. And their well actually came up and says, why do we need to cut up? But everything else was going down. That's all hydrologically tied. And so we've got to manage the whole system together. Question here.
Just trying to get just an overview of the situation. If I understand the discussion, it's about 35% reduction before you factor in growth, but where we're sitting tonight. The water that's being consumed in this community, you need to cut that by a third, let's say, and that's before any new development, any new housing, any new business, any way to grow the economy in the community.
With everything we're doing right now, we were taking about that 30-35% more water than is really available under State Field. So anything new that wants to come in, that's going to make it even worse.
And at this moment, there's not at least a large way to contribute more water to the system. So we're in a confined water system. We're not going to be able to ship it in from somewhere. That's not really feasible. Pipeline, diversion of the water we have. There's this much water, reduce consumption by a third, and then begin working.
I agree with what you're saying. I've heard some really good discussions on horizontal drilling. You would have to go so far that it's just not cost effective to do that kind of thing. But yes, I think that's
the reality of the situation. We have technology today.
Cedar City in the Central Iron County Water Conservancy District is talking about going a few valleys over and putting in some wells. Actually importing water in to help solve some of the problems, but that's probably somewhere between 30 and 90 years. I don't know how long that's going to take, but they're looking at that. That might be something to do to help to import water, but I don't
have that time. As the state representative, what we're talking about this reduction is 30%, this is the one third. That has to happen in a reasonable amount of time from today.
It has to happen in a reasonable amount of time.
But
what is reasonable, and I'm saying gradual, this discussion we're talking with Cedar City folks is I think we're looking somewhere 40 years or so in that race. We haven't come to that final number yet, but it's going to be a while. And again, it's taken 7 years to get to the problem. It's taken that long to get that problem here, but we got to fix it. And so I'm not going to come in and say, okay, by 2021, we got to get this fixed, but and that will be a lot based too on the input that you folks give to us about how we can best implement this. And I'm totally supportive of a gradual implementation, but it has to be done. We have to realize there's a problem, and we need to get started on how to solve this. So,
and it's interesting to know the last 5 to 10 years, there was a time there that Perrin Valley was the least affected relative to world. Newcastle area and Cedar. And now as a result of this USGS study has become maybe number one critical out of those three valleys. And so hopefully it's winter snowpack and climate change all in our favor instead of, and we revise that USGS.
I'm going to be totally observant of studies that have been done. We're going to encourage evaluating the data and doing as many studies as we can to make sure we're making the right decisions. But you can see historically since the 40s, we're doing this. And we monitor that every year, and it's doing this. And until I can get it to stabilize, we're not fixed. And then in the study next year, I might say, well, we've got enough. And I'm going to look at those well levels and see what's happening to them, because I need to get that drop to stop. Yeah.
Are there any studies done outside of the USGS that you observe? Any studies, or just to avoid political bias, is there anything outside?
We will look at any studies that are available. I know the Utah Geological Survey, we've actually brought in to do several of our studies to kind of look at things. We've looked at some professional engineering studies too, but sometimes studies kind of show whoever hired you to do that study shows those results in your favor, which is a little troubling, so you have to kind of read through all of that. But we will look at any credible scientific study to kind of help us make those decisions. Yeah.
Just one comment. I just asked you to notice that a substantial portion of this aquifer, Parowan Valley Aquifer, is within Central Iron County Water Conservancy District. I hope you'll take that into account.
Part of the valley is in the Central Iron County Water Conservancy District.
Right. Iron County Water Conservancy
District. And if it is, then you're actually paying toward to help solve future water problems.
A substantial portion of the valley is actually.
So that might be one source to go to kind of help talk about planning and how we're going to meet this in the future.
Is there a kind of average static water level drop over that long period? It looks like at our place it's been about a half a foot a year, and it seems like that was pretty true as I was trying to watch those numbers. That's how it's been falling everywhere in the valley.
James, as far as you run away.
So, of
course, as far as an average water drop per year, have you looked at that? For David, do we?
I can find it out. I don't. Probably 2 to 3 feet per year, depending on where you're at.
Okay, and he's saying his well is about a half a foot a year.
Some of those numbers on your graphs, it looks like if you took them across a long period, you'd see, you know, a half a foot a year.
Some of those I was looking at, I've got about 80 feet drop over a 60 to 70 year time frame. So it's probably a little bit more than a half. But
it depends on where you're at. It's probably somewhere in that range.
And some of the wells that aren't being pumped quite as heavily, you wouldn't see that. But on the valley as a whole, we're probably at.
How deep can you afford to pump?
We actually brought an economist in Burrell Enterprise to start looking at that, just saying how can you afford to grow hay, and you look at the price of hay, and I don't know exactly what the chemical it says, but you start going 2 minutes deeper, and we had one consultant out there says, well, we can keep pumping, and well, we can drop that another 500 feet, we can still keep farming. You add 500 feet to your well pumping costs and think that you can grow an economically viable product to sell. Maybe the new legislation that passed with our cannabis product. Colorado seems to be doing really well with some of the product, but I don't see that happening. And there's got to be a pretty high price crop in order to pay. I just don't see it happening.
I think there's some practical things we can. You know, years ago when most of us had wheel lines, we didn't want to move them on Sunday for various reasons, and so we just shut off on Sunday, not the whole valley. But what if everybody just shut off every Sunday? We'd have to, you know, have an agreement so everybody lived up to it. If I figured that would be a 14% reduction right there. But when we went to the pivots, then, you know, we didn't have to go move them, so we just kept leaving them on Sunday, most of us. So that's a practical thing that could be done, and obviously you wouldn't have quite as much water on your farm, but everybody would basically contribute the same. So, and we've done, Sam was headed up, he's our pumpers association president, but I guess Don is now. Anyway, they headed up a little reach out project, but, you know, so we're doing something, we're making a difference. And one other thing, and I brought this up before in Cedar with you, but I know it's hard to know what's underground, but the state made the mistake of over-appropriating. So, Senator Vickers, why don't we appropriate a few million a year and buy out some of these junior rides and not put that on us? Well, it would be on all of you, because we all pay taxes, but that's a thought that I put out there a few times and haven't gotten very far, but.
Yeah, and that's a difficult thing. And I've heard that in other bases too. So the state engineer, you shouldn't approve all those rights, and we wouldn't have this kind of trouble. That the state engineer's responsibility is to put the waters of the state to their most beneficial use and give people the opportunity to do that. Historically, people file for water rights, they develop water, they have to submit proof that they've done that, and sometimes they develop the whole thing, sometimes they only do part of it. And so we actually just typically would approve more water than we would think water is available, because we know some people aren't going to do that. But we're not finding many people that want to give up on their water rights. So they're really pushing hard to develop, and so things aren't going away like I think previous state engineers have thought maybe they would. And so they got over out there, but it gave people the opportunity to use it when somebody else wasn't using it. In Salt Lake Valley, we've got some really old water rights that just aren't being used right now. Some of the junior guys are still using it under those rights. Had we stopped at Safefield, they wouldn't have had the right. But it gives them the right to use it for until that time when the senior rights start using it and then they have to get cut off. Again, just like a surface source, if you're not using your surface source, somebody else wants to use it. We let the junior users use that water. But if the senior user comes back and says, I want to use it, then the junior user gets cut off. And that's kind of the way it's gone historically with the state engineers. I just looked at the history. First state engineer was put in 1897, 1 year after statehood, to help solve water problems. If you can believe it, had water problems back in the 1800s, right? It's a commodity that just people don't share very well. And it's not just Utah here, but we've had problems with that just because it's such a limited resource. But the state engineer was put in to help regulate the water, just help make sure people were sharing. Taught them how to put head gates in and measuring devices so that we knew who was getting what. But we try to give it people who want to have the opportunity to use the water, that opportunity to use it, even though it might be over-allocated, because if somebody's not using it, you go ahead and use it. But understand there's rights that may cut you off when they actually start using it again.
Well, it was that way. I know in Burla, Esplanade, that way many years ago, we had some pretty aggressive farmers out there, and I think they have almost every bit of it. In Huron Valley, in the last 10 years, that's pretty well happened. We had a lot that was on the books, but now it's pretty much all pumped, And so that theory doesn't really work anymore because of the economics.
I agree. So how do we help junior users retire? It's easier for me by statute. It's just priority gone, okay? But that's really difficult if you're a junior user and I have to come in and tell you you can't pump anymore. Then what do you do? That's my livelihood. You can't take that.
Well, not only that, because you're telling the house to shut their culinary system off and haul water in for their wash, correct?
If you've got a home that you've drilled a well in and you've got a 2001 priority, that priority is terrible for what you need to have here. And homes are not exempt. Some states, they actually exempt domestic and give you the right to use it. But what we found in Utah, even home wells, you start putting all the home wells together and they impact senior users. And everybody should be regulated, I think. So what Burl Enterprise, they talked about this in their plan too. And then what they decided, says we've got a lot of our kids and our grandkids that build homes with these junior rights, and they've actually come back and said, okay, well, what we're going to do is find our senior rights and break up a small portion of those, and we're going to make sure that they'll file a change application of the older rights and get the older rights to cover the home so when this priority cut comes, they don't have to shut their homes down. And that's going to be really fun for the state engineer to do that, not going to, you can't use your well anymore.
Or you could do that to the city, knock on their door and say, hey, we're pumping 500 units, those houses need to be shut off.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's the reality that we're coming to. And I know discussions with Cedar City, some of the more junior rights in Cedar City Valley are owned by Cedar City. And they're looking, okay, how are we going to solve that? And I'm not sure on the priority with Parowan where that fits in with everything, But they are a water user just like everybody else, and they will be treated equally just like everybody else. But it's tough because they're in the process of supplying water to a lot of homes. And so how do you cover that? There's going to have to be a plan then to help you, either through ag water conversion or conservation, combinations of a whole bunch of things that we're going to need to look at in order for us to be able to meet this future stabilization of the groundwater and to meet future projected needs, Captain, because I don't want to come in here and say Berwyn can't grow anymore. I mean, you want to do that. You want to be able to provide homes and grow, but where is that water going to come from? How are we going to meet those needs? And that's what we've got to solve. So that's what I'm asking for your help for. Cedar City is going to be a process since the first meeting we had, and it's going to be a couple of years before we actually come up with this plan. And I'm anticipating we're not going to be much faster than that here, but we're going to go through James' record. We want people's comments on this meeting, right? James mentioned that you go to our website and have some, if you can't find something to do like Christmas Eve, go on and listen to the meeting. If you run out of something you need to do on that, because this is recorded, you actually look at it and look at the slides. We'd like to have you send some written comments, and let's get started with this, okay? And again, you can go to the website, and this slide will be on the website. You can look at it, but we want to set a time frame, maybe 60 days or so. Let's shoot to get some comments in for 60 days. I would request during the holidays for at least a week that don't think about this, but then come right back and start thinking about it, because there's some things that we need to do to get this solved. So, yeah.
How junior would the line be now if you had to do it today? How junior would you have to be?
So we haven't determined what that is. We haven't set that line yet. But it's somewhere in that range of 22,000 acre feet to 24 or something.
We can't see a running total probably as we're looking down that list of...
You can't. We've got a running total on that. You have to see. But until we get everything refined, we're not going to know exactly where that is.
But, just in the neighborhood. But you'll know everything before...
So what do you think the priority dating date would be?
That's, he's just going to look at that, I think. You're into the 40s now, 30s?
1950s?
So in the 1950s.
Everything after that is...
That's what this is showing right now. And if you're interested in it, you're well, you can go to this list on our website. You actually see where you fit in relationship to everybody else. And that's a problem. Again, we want to work together to get it solved. So please get us some comments. Appreciate you being here tonight. You have a question here?
It seems like your suggestion is a municipal problem. It's not municipal, including the county, or part of the county. It's a valley problem. So what mechanism exists for the valley to get together and sort out?
So what mechanism exists to help the valley get together to sort it out? We don't have anything by statute on how you can do that. I know there's some discussions this year through the Utah Water Task Force. It's recommendations that I don't know if they're going to come before the legislature this year or not, talking about getting citizens advisory committees established. It may be a way to go about doing that. So there's no legal process, but working through county government, working through city governments. I know you've talked to Cedar City people about how they pull together. They've got cities represented, they've got the county, they've got irrigators. They just pulled together a group, a big cross-section of people that wanted to volunteer. People kind of came together and volunteered and said, I'd like to serve on this committee. I don't know who coordinates that. We haven't done that, but they've kind of done that on their own. That's the same thing that happened in Berlin Enterprise. We had a major group of the water users, including agricultural and municipal, that came together to just form a committee, and they just said, okay, we're willing to do that. Cedar City Valley hold regular meetings, and they meet at least monthly, and just kind of talk about what they've got going on and what the plans are and where they need to keep moving. So they're just kind of keeping that in a routine, which I think is great to be able to do that. But I think we just... That can be part of this discussion about how we pull a group together. So I don't have all the answers on that.
There is a fairly informal group, but we've existed as agricultural primarily for years. And that, we're called the Perrin Valley Peppers Association. And one of those is to fulfill your requirement, but the same group of people separately will be involved in this process, and we need to develop a better mailing order and contact list to make sure that others are involved in that. Vaughn is our current chairman, president of that group, and if I come up with something better, that's the current operating group.
I think we should dump it all on Vaughn.
No.
That's just what he wants. No, I think that's great. But that, I know we've got our commissioner here that kind of helps watch the use in the valley, and we prepare annual reports about pumping amounts of water. But that, you know, there is an organization that we work with our commissioner, and that would be this group, right, the Perrin Valley Pumpers. And so that might be a place to start, and then make sure you got everybody represented on that too.
One question about reservoirs, developing reservoirs, and then to maybe rest wells, and economically maybe guys in the foothills maybe utilize that. I know they have water rights. Is the state willing to help with the operator or somebody with the water rights if they're willing to rest their well and develop some reservoirs and with that surface water and let that, you know, that underground aquifer get back, you know, percolations. I think there should, number one, I don't think in this country we got enough reservoirs, and we all agree upon that, but I think we could do some developments of that. But if, on the state's part, they'd be willing to compensate, or economically, if you put the food on your table, you know, you got to keep farming. If there's ways like that, we could help that water aquifer, you know, develop itself, but maybe make some man-made reservoirs and maybe disperse that water, you know, on the surface. Is there something that you could help as a state acknowledge that, you know, so you don't, you know, lose them rights, whatever?
I really think that's a possibility. One thing we ought to look at, somebody has suggested to me that maybe we take groundwater pumping rights and actually convert them to surface storage somehow. And we, for most of my career, I've had people come to the division, I've heard discussions of it, and I've had some talk to me personally about like enlarging reservoirs and storing more water in there. And the answer has always been, you know what, if we store more water in a reservoir, it's going to stop the water going down to the valley, and the valley's going to get hurt because that's where it goes. And I've always said, well, if you can show me that water that you're going to store was water that would have run through the valley and out to Little Salt Lake and just evaporated, we'd be lost to the system. I think we could store more, but we have to be really careful to keep it in the
And that's what we've done with some of the winter water coming out of the Perrin Valley. We put it into the old Perrin sewer ponds, which had to be abandoned because they wouldn't hold the sewage. So I got a letter from the state engineer saying that we have to update, we have to show proof of a beneficial use for that diversion, right, and charge us $50 for the application. And they said if we don't show beneficial use, how do I show beneficial use when there's no study that has been done to show that it's brought the aquifer up? And then otherwise, the water just going out to the lake and evaporating. So even if it's not a beneficial use, according to the Utah code law that they sent me in this letter, we have to let it go. We can't use it to try to recharge our aquifer if we don't pay them their $50. And then that's only good until the year 2020, so two more years from now, we have to give them another $50 to allow us to try to recharge our aquifer. And this is making it hard and difficult for us to try to fix our problem.
I know that state engineer is a tough guy to work with. He's just penny pincher. We are responsible through legislative direction to make sure everybody that has water rights is following statute. And if you have a water right, we don't want people just having water rights and then sitting on them and not doing anything with it. So if you need a water right, get a water right and then put it to use. And my instructions are, make sure people are being diligent or have a reasonable cause for delay on a water right, or let somebody else use it. Let that water right, let somebody else do it who really wants to do it. Now, if we've got long-term projects, certainly that's a reason, you know, that we can get extensions. But yeah, it is, there is a fee set up, established, that tells us what we have to charge for applications. So I didn't just make it up. But they're saying if you're going to go through that process, but some of the discussion might be, well, we need a little bit longer time.
That's what I put in for the new application for that, for that. Yeah. But it's water that's not being used in any other way. It's just going out to the lake during the off season of the winter runoff.
Yeah, see, and I think if we get that water that's just going out and then eventually evaporating, if we get that into the aquifer somehow, yeah, that's what makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Have you ever, there's one aspect I think that's kind of been overlooked a little bit, and that is, if you look at the historical basis for of the runoff in this state, it was a lot higher in years past, and it isn't because of wet winters, because our mountains were a lot more conifer, or not conifer, they're a lot more aspen-based, and they discharge a lot more water. Now we have these forests that have been mismanaged to the point that they're unproductive. I mean, and they're causing a lot of problems. I think you'll see in this fire up here that you will see a lot of benefit from that as far as from a watershed perspective, especially under that north exposure. But does the state have any influence on the Forest Service to start managing these lands so that we can benefit from them like we used to?
Senator Griffith, do you want to address that? It's a battle that's ongoing. We've got some really strong advocates for that. I don't know. We're continually talking.
Isn't it a fact that we used to have more water, not because of climate, but because of the condition of our mountains?
I will not disagree with that. I will not disagree. And I've been.
So you are agreeing.
I will agree with that.
But I think it's a pretty accurate that the climate has. We've reduced our winter snowpack in the last, especially 20 years. I mean, measurably less snowpack.
Well, that's true, Sam, but have you been up there and seen, do you know what those mountains, they're so overrun that nothing can function in its proper succession anymore.
Same in the DJ areas, too.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't going to let BLM get off the hook.
Okay. Good for you.
Who said that?
I've been interested in discussions about the burn area. The people come to me and says, hey, we've got springs coming back that just haven't flowed for years and years. They're flowing now. They've got water running. I think that's great. I think they will until vegetation comes back and we'll start using that. From the numbers I've seen about
it. It can be managed in a proactive manner if they would do it.
I agree. And an interesting thing that's just happened is, well, in fact, it's in the governor's budget this year, recommended some money allocations to buy a forest on Tabby Mountain in the Uinta Basin, and there's going to be a Utah forest, and Utah, several agencies are going to come together and manage that forest just to demonstrate that we can do a great job at managing forests and get them to be productive. We'll see where the legislature goes this year on those kind of discussions, but just some really interesting things about.
But can't the state have any influence on these federal agencies to do something from a watershed perspective? You know, not just even a fire suppression, but from a watershed perspective.
You know, we are doing some very significant things in the state right now through the Watershed Restoration Initiative. We've actually got a lot of federal agencies working with us and helping buy seed and helping with the chaining processes. Particularly, we've had a lot of support from the BLM working there. The Forest Service has been a little bit more hesitant, but they even are stepping up and helping us do some things. And I liken Utah to a little dog that's been under your pant leg. You know, and that's kind of what we've been for the past several years, living watching. Trying to get people to pay attention. And
well, that program needs to be commended.
Yeah, they're doing a great job.
That needs to be commended. And, you know, Senator Vickers, this program has done more for the state that we've seen more monies put in that on the ground and into, you know, vegetation rehab and for the benefit of wildlife, you know, livestock and watershed and everything than we have for years. And it's the BLM has really jumped on board with all these other agencies. And it's been a great, great project. And I want to commend everybody for that. We appreciate it. We just need to get the forest on board.
And we appreciate that, too, because I think there have been some good things, some authorizations through the legislature to help fund some of those things and support that program. And the people working in the program are just doing a great job working. We're seeing some real benefits from that, and I agree. So we're going to continue to push to try to get that done for better forest management, because I think we'll be able to get more water developed. But I think underlying it was mentioned that we've got a problem with not quite as much snowpack. They're projecting we're probably going to get more rainfall than snow in the future.
But the point is, you have no control over that snowpack, but you can over some of these federal agencies.
You know, just quickly, it's time to go, but the Trump administration has been a lot more cooperative than the previous administration. So there's pockets of areas like, you know, water restoration, you know, those types of programs. We've actually had some better cooperation with fire and wildland fire. There's a few of the areas where we've had more cooperation than others. Typically, like Kent says, the BLM has been more cooperative than the Forest Service. And that depends, too, on the particular area of the state. But what I will say as a general observation that under the Trump administration, it's been much better than the previous administration.
Oh, no question.
Yeah, and we've seen that too. So we appreciate the efforts, but I don't think we're there yet either. And we need to keep pushing and need to keep reminding and encouraging things to get better. I look at some of the numbers, just generally rule of thumb thing, about 80% of the water that falls on the state of Utah is used by natural vegetation. We only use like 20% of the water. Another 20% we use, 80% of that's used for agriculture. So, and 20% then for everything else. So, I've also told people, if you want more water, just kill all the trees. So we did with the fire, right? That's so we should have more water, but I'm not going to encourage that because I really like, we were looking at the picture of Yankee Meadows over here before the meeting, and I know it doesn't look like that now. I would rather look at
how much did that reservoir fill up better this year in the dry year than it has
There it is. Did it fill up with logs and dirt, or was it really water?
Kent Creek did. Luckily, they pulled them aside and they got them out of there. No, but ours didn't get much sediment or log.
Yeah, that's really
good.
That's really good. Okay, and there's some great things to think about. Another question here?
Yeah. In the earlier presentation, you had a line there about flood rest stop. I would dare say that we don't need 30% cut there to bring to get the same yield compared to the rest of the valley. Is there going to be any separation between us and them?
Okay, and that's something we're still going to look at. We're going to look at the formations and how the water moves, and there might be some separations in the valley about how we're going to do that. Cedar City Valley, we're ending up with some separations just because of how where the groundwater impacts are, where the recharge areas are, so we'll be looking at that. So we haven't decided all that yet, but that's part of what we want to have a discussion about. Okay? Thank you. So an hour. This is apparently an hour. Just turn your clocks back. So thank you so much for being here. Remember the 60 days. If you'd like to submit written comments to us, we would. At some time, several months from now, we're going to try to set up another meeting. We'll come back and talk about the comments. Thank you for spending your time and being here. Appreciate it.